Stand Up with Pete Dominic. With Pete Dominic. On Indy, Sirius XM 104.
All right. Well, now is the fun part of the show. We haven't had a lot of fun today. We usually had some fun. And we are joined by one of our favorite guests, a good friend of mine. He's an associate professor of pediatrics and director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University. And he's the author of Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Your Health. His most recent book is the sequel to that, Don't Crush Your Eyes, They'll Get Stuck That Way. He blogs at The Incidental Economist, and most importantly, everybody, you should be following him on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll, two R's, two L's. Good morning, Dr. Carroll.
Good morning, how are you?
I'm good. What are you wearing?
A shirt and jeans.
Why has someone attacked you, and do you know this person on Twitter who's attacked you and said that you wear a hairpiece and that I should get you to admit that? I know for a fact, as I said on Twitter, I'd love for you to be wearing a hairpiece. There'd be nothing that could make me happier than you being a phony. I have pulled on your hair with all of my might. It is real. Why would someone say this?
Amazingly enough, that's a guy I played on a softball team with when I was in like third or fourth grade, and then we went to camp together for years.
So you do know this person?
I do, but I haven't seen him in 20 years, I think, at least. So okay. Not since I left Philly a long time ago. So
probably another
while,
bald.
Yes, I do.
Probably
know.
Another bald man, just jealous.
He balding.
There you go. At Aaron E. Carroll, joining us right now. You know, we've been talking a lot, obviously, about veterans issues this week. With this whole Storm the Hill initiative with IAVA. When you look at the veterans hospitals, can you explain to us a little bit about how that system is set up and how it works, what you think is important? Because, you know, most of us don't have experience with the veterans hospitals necessarily. I would think there's a lot of families and members of the military who obviously get health care from them. But one of the problems seems obvious is there just aren't enough of them, and with the way that, you know, our country is so spread out, and many of the members of the military obviously live in rural areas, it's hard sometimes just to get into a hospital because it's far away. But explain to us what you see as, you know, how the system works and maybe what some of the problems are.
Sure. The Veterans Hospital, you know, we talk all the time about how, you know, the Medicare system is a single-payer healthcare system, and it's just like Canada's system. Well, the Veterans Administration, the VA system, is a completely socialized healthcare system. It's like England's healthcare system. It's run by the government. It's paid for by the government. It's owned by the government. It's in an entirely government-run system. So every time we talk about how America can never tolerate this kind of stuff, you can always remember that Medicare is like Canada and the VA is like England. And, of course, being like England's healthcare system, it has some of the good and bad things about it. Some of the good things about it is that it's pretty efficient. It's very cheap. It probably has the most robust and connected information system of any healthcare system in the country. Their computer medical record, electronic medical record system, is really second to none almost in the United States and is actually free. Anyone could really use it, but they've done a great job with it. They do a lot of decision support, and they've published a lot of good research about it. In the past, they've had knocks against them in terms of quality, because like any bureaucracy, it can get mired down and can be very also problematic as well. And so decades ago, there was a well-deserved rap against the VA that it was not a great place to get health care. But that has changed in the last since that time. They've done a lot of work towards improving quality. They've had a lot of quality initiatives. And there's, again, a lot of research showing that they are doing a much, much better job than they used to in trying to provide high-quality, efficient health care for a reasonable price. But they are budget-constrained. They are resource-constrained. And so you only can sort of get out of it what you put into it. And these days we keep trying to cut everything with respect to government, and the VA is bundled in there. So you will hear a lot about people who want to access the VA from the military who can't get in. Partially that's because there's waiting lists. I mean, the things, again, you hear about from, say, in England, you know, whether they're overblown or not, it can be very hard to get into the VA based upon some of the ways that they prioritize who should get care. They are, again, resource limited in the sense that there's not enough money often to provide the services that we want, because somehow we imagine that healthcare should, you know, at the same time be awesome, but we don't want to spend money on anything. And finally, it's important to remember that we've had couple wars in the last, you know, decade or so, and so that has increased the severity and the number of people who need to access such a system, and yet we're not increasing the amount that we want to spend on that healthcare appropriately. And so while more and more service members, people in the military need high-quality healthcare, especially mental health care, which is often overlooked for people who have served and are now coming back, there's not enough money to go around. So people will often look at a system like they do with England and say, hey, look at the problems. It's a problem with the system. It's not. It's a problem with the fact that we expect it to be dirt cheap, and we don't want to spend as much on that as we do on our private healthcare system, and yet somehow we still expect it to perform at the same level, if not better.
Well, I think that it seems to be the problem. One of the big problems is, seems to be fairly straightforward, and I'll try to use an analogy to explain it. If you build a bridge planning on just bicycles crossing that bridge or just pedestrian traffic, and then all of a sudden the bridge is constantly trafficked by big tankers and semis, the bridge is going to collapse. The VA system was not prepared for the amount of patients it was going to have to treat based on these wars. It seems like they just weren't staffed. They weren't prepared. There wasn't the infrastructure in place for these wars.
Well, we say it's not prepared. It all comes down to money. You have to remember that. It's like, you know, in the end, it's not that, like, we can't get the doctors to work in the VA. There are plenty of doctors there. And it's like we can't get the – or we couldn't get nurses, or we couldn't get physical therapists, or we couldn't get mental health. We absolutely could get people working if we need to. We could reorganize the system. A lot of it is how much you want to spend and how much you want to sort of dedicate to these kinds of activities, because we have plenty of money in the United States, you know, contrary to what people hear. Compared to other countries, we're still very wealthy, and it's just how much we want to spend. And yet I don't see any politicians out there, or very few at least, talking about how we need to increase the budget of the VA or how much government spends in order to accommodate the mental health problems of returning service members. I don't see many politicians out there talking about how we need to up the number of VAs or figure out how to build more or get more out of it or spend more. Everyone's talking about how much we need to cut at the same time when they are, you know, increasing the number of people who are returning home wounded in the last decade or who have significant health or mental health problems. It's part of it is a matter of will. And it's also, you have to own that, like, the VA is the government. It's not as if there's some private, you know, healthcare group which is just waiting to pick up the slack. We have a government-run system, and if you cut government, the government-run system is going to get cut. And it's just not something that we seem to be prioritizing at the moment, and we could. There's no reason we couldn't. But, on your show you talk about all the time how people are just not aware enough of how many people are actually serving overseas, or they don't perhaps know someone, or they're just not connected enough to understand that the war is going on. The flip side of that is there are too many people probably who don't know a veteran who is suffering either from physical or mental health problems and can't get the care they need because they can't go to the hospital. Instead, they turn on the TV and they hear about how, you know, we need to cut health care, we need to cut how much we're doing, we're spending too much, there's too much waste, and all of that feeds into this belief somehow that we need to cut, not expand.
When the VA has the ability, because of the way it's set up, the VA has the ability to bargain for drug prices. Explain the difference between what the VA can do on medications versus Medicare, Medicaid, or obviously any other insurance, private insurance.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of this is just straight up, you know, no, I don't want to say simple, but it's straightforward economics. Because the larger you are, the more negotiating power you have. If you're buying one thing from somebody, they'll charge you whatever price that they want. If you're buying a ton of it, well, they're going to give you a good deal, because the more that you buy from them, the more money they'll make, and what they might lose in sort of markup, they'll certainly make up in volume. The VA is allowed to buy as one big system, which means they don't just buy, you know, one prescription. They're buying a ton of prescriptions. And it's not even that they're buying, you know, 5,000 prescriptions. They're buying all the VA systems. And so the VA can negotiate as one big group, and drug companies and other groups will cut them huge discounts because they can, you know, they'll get a ton of business. And it's worth it to them to give people a discount in order to get that big business. Because of that, the VA actually gets some of the lowest prices around when it comes to pharmaceuticals and often medical devices and things like that. And I know Austin's actually written papers on this, and it's certainly on our blog, about how much money the Medicare Part D system could make if it just got VA prices. And again, that's not saying like we want, you know, we want them to go out of business. They're making a profit selling this stuff to the VA. There's no reason to think that they couldn't make a profit selling it to Medicare as well. But Medicare is expressly prohibited by law from negotiating for discounts and for prices in the same way that the VA is. I leave it to other people to try to explain why that's so. I have cynical reasons, of course, but nobody will ever know what's in the heart of the people who voted for those laws. But the VA can get much better deals than Medicare can, certainly than private insurance can, and certainly better than you as an individual can.
We're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll. He's on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. He blogs incessantly at the Incidental Economist. We're having, obviously, we have been having a long debate about the budget and about, especially about what are oftentimes referred to as entitlements. One of the arguments that you often hear, it's kind of common sense, conventional wisdom now, is that we need to reform our entitlements. I've argued, and I want you to correct me, that I've said more than we need to reform our entitlements, we need to bring down the costs of care. So it's not like we need to change who gets Medicare when, or necessarily how they get it, who qualifies, and means tests, and so on. I've thought that if we really want to bring down, spend less on Medicare, we should do a lot more to bring down the cost of care. So when you hear someone say we need to reform Medicare, I usually answer that with we need to find ways to bring down the cost of Medicare. We don't necessarily need to reform Medicare. So split the difference there.
Also, it's important to remember that I'm not sure I agree with you. I think when some people are saying they need to reform entitlements, they're talking about Medicaid and not Medicare. Because if we're talking about the House budget, for all the talk about reforming Medicare, they don't want to do anything about it for a decade. It won't affect anything for anyone age 55 or above, which means it's such a crisis that we don't need to touch it for 10 years. When they say they're reforming entitlements now, I think most often people are talking about Medicaid. But even getting to your point about Medicare, yes, we have to bring down how much health care costs. Medicare doesn't go up because it's some crazy, people are getting cash in their pocket program and then they're using it to buy whatever they want. It's reimbursement for the health care system when people get health care. It's not going into their pockets, people's. So Medicare is going up not because, people are demanding more and more money. Medicare is going up because how much health care costs is going up at an unsustainable rate. But here's the thing. In the last few years, healthcare has actually slowed significantly. And no one knows if this is because of the Affordable Care Act or if this is because of the bad economy or if this is because things are working in general, even with or without the Affordable Care Act. But healthcare costs have been rising barely faster than inflation the past few years. And actually, if that holds and no one knows if it will, that will change all the projections that we have about how much healthcare will cost us in the future. All of the big concerns about how much we're going to spend and how healthcare is what's going to ruin us are based on healthcare growth of, say, the last decade, not the last few years. And it's hard to see how much change is going to be. Of course, this doesn't stop anyone from screaming about how we have a crisis and if we don't fix it now, then we're all going to go into a ditch. Of course, fixing it now means doing nothing for 10 years and then, fixing it. So the whole thing is rather convoluted. If we're talking about Medicaid, that's an entirely different story. Again, people talk about entitlements as if they are all the way that people used to talk about welfare, as if you're going to get cash or a check and then, not work and then buy whatever you want and live a lifestyle that was almost hedonistic and somehow never have to work and the government will support you.
No, you're describing the people on Medicaid.
Well, it's important to remember who's on Medicaid first. It's again, the vast majority of people on Medicaid today are children, pregnant women, poor elderly people, and the blind and disabled. That's something like 85 to 90% of people on Medicaid. Which of those four groups, again, is the one that you think should get off their butt and go work harder?
Can we put the blind,
the
disabled
women?
Children in a category?
Children, pregnant women,
no, blind, disabled children, I would probably throw away.
Okay. So might as well get them. This is not like we're talking about work-eligible adults and that they're just being lazy. So the vast, vast, vast majority of people.
These are the people. These are the women who only have babies to get Medicaid.
But again, let's think about it. They can only have the Medicaid while they're pregnant, first of all. And secondly, all you get when you're on Medicaid is payment for your health care and your pregnancy. Again, there's no cash. There's no cake and makes your life better. All that you get is the health care that you need during your pregnancy. And when you're done being pregnant, your Medicaid will often go away. So getting pregnant only gets you coverage for that pregnancy. There is no net gain above the health care. And again,
so Medicaid, there's no check.
It's just reimbursement to physicians and hospitals. It is not in your pocket.
You can't buy food or anything else?
No. You can't buy anything. Medicaid is reimbursement to doctors and hospitals and pharmacies and everything else for the health care that you're using. And for pregnant women, it's the health care you're using while you're pregnant. So the whole myth about, I'm going to have more children because that'll get me on Medicaid, that does not get you Medicaid. And even if it does, all it gets you is the health care. It's like you can't get anything else. Your life does not markedly become better other than the fact that you're getting your health care, and that may free you up and make your life. And don't get me wrong, that can make your life better. But it is not as if you can support any other aspect of your life more easily once the big fat Medicaid check comes. So somehow the idea that this is some entitlement that's trapping people or making people lazy or, you know, since I can get Medicaid, I don't need to work, it's really hard to wrap yourself around that, especially when you consider who actually benefits from the program.
We usually spend an hour talking to Dr. Carroll and take a lot of calls, but I've decided to dump him for CNN's new Jake Tapper show.
Doctor.
Jake Tapper is going to join us, and so you are bumped for Jake Tapper.
That's
your feelings on that?
Well, you know, you've already bumped me. What was that for that guy that didn't even win an Academy Award?
Oh, right, the documentary.
I get bumped for just nominees now. It's ridiculous.
Well, he is an Israeli. He's Jewish. That doesn't matter to you?
No.
You don't care if you're bumped for another member of the tribe?
No.
That makes no difference.
I don't like anybody bumping me, period.
Fair enough. Let's go to, is that Lance in Virginia? Go ahead, Lance. You're on Stand Up with Dr. Aaron Carroll.
There's a couple of things I want to mention real quick. I noticed you, Dr. Carroll, mentioned the fact that the Veterans Affairs healthcare system is basically a socialist system. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that veterans are special kinds of citizens and we can create a socialist healthcare system for them. And it would be unconstitutional to create it for the rest of Americans. I just want to say that. But I really wanted to talk about something Congressman Wolf mentioned, which is the fact that the Department of Defense's personnel and medical system and the Veteran Affairs personnel and medical system, or client and medical system, I suppose it is, don't talk to each other, and you end up jumping on these poor ex-servicemen, reams of documents and expect them to translate it from one system to the other. What I do for the government, Pete, is I maintain and develop a database system for them. And I know this is a simple thing to do. All you need to do is add a data bit to the personnel system, to the medical system that says veteran. And when it's off, they're a serviceman. And when they become a veteran, you turn it on, and the records become accessible to the Department of Veterans Affairs. And that's everything that should be done. And you'd be saving millions of dollars of
it can't processors. Be. It can't be that simple.
I don't think the caller's wrong. I don't think the caller's necessarily wrong, but what he just described is not a problem with the VA. It's a problem with the entire U.S. healthcare system. People in the private sector have the exact same problem, where one office doesn't talk to another office, doesn't talk to the hospital, because they have completely different information systems, and you're asked to fill out the same paperwork 1,000 times over and over again, and it's impossible. That is how the U.S. works. And yes, I wish we could fix it for the VA. And look, most of my research is in information technology, and I absolutely believe we could do so much of a better job. I would just add that that's not necessarily a government problem. That's an entire U.S. healthcare system problem.
Well, I would mention in the private sector, in my read of it, is doctors think the medical records that they generate on their patients is the doctor's work product. And they believe they own that. And that's why they do not buy into a universal system. You were saying that the VA healthcare system, medical record system, is, you know, a really great system. It's a government system.
Yep.
Everybody should just have it.
Well, first of all, that's an entirely different discussion, and I'm not saying we shouldn't. I just think that the problem that we're pointing out with data is not inherent to the VA.
Yeah.
The problem is inherent to everything. And I think that doctors I think there are probably some doctors that view it as their work product, but I know plenty of physicians, and you know, surveys would back me up, who absolutely loathe the fact that they have to keep entering the same information, that they can't get records transferred from one place right. to the other, and that they have to keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, and that they're totally inefficient. Everyone hates it. It's just that we don't seem to figure out a way to do anything about it.
Lance, great, great call. I hung up on you, but thank you very much. Pete in New York, if you'd like to talk to Dr. Aaron Carroll, if you'd like to argue, if you'd like to question, 866, the phone number is 866-994-6343. Go ahead, Pete.
I had two questions. One, just based on what the caller said, if you could just touch on the issue of privacy with electronic health records. I mean, my God, the government's, you know, already digging through all of our info if they, you know, have access to our DNA. But my other question was, you know, in terms of Medicare negotiating for prices, it seems like more of the argument of shuffling around how things are paid for instead of actually dealing with the healthcare system. If AstraZeneca or Pfizer has a certain PDE ratio on their stock and all of a sudden they're not making enough on Medicare, are they just shifting that to the other people that aren't on Medicare, you know, through other negotiations? So in essence, the American people as a whole will be paying the same amount.
Yeah. Cost shifting is one of those arguments that makes total sense and everybody intuitively gets it, but there's a fairly large amount of research on this. Again, you know, I'm not plugging our blog. We have an enormous amount that we've written about this. The research shows that cost shifting is not nearly as pervasive as people seem to think it is. That the amount that gets moved around based upon, you know, whether it's Medicare or Medicaid or private insurance or anything else, it's a mythical thing. Yeah, it's apocryphal. It sounds like it's, you know, what they would do, but it's very hard to do, and hospitals don't do such a good job of it at all. The healthcare system is not good at that. So if Medicare spends a little bit less, it is not something that everybody should worry about, that all of a sudden everything else is going to go up. It just doesn't happen so much. And moreover, it's the kind of thing that anybody who believes we should have any kind of quote-unquote skin in the game, that exposing people to prices is what will actually lower costs, they should be all for that kind of thing then. Because in other words, if Medicare starts paying less, then everyone else will pay more. That'll be the market signal, which would drive people to finally rebel and say, we're not paying this much anymore, and then prices would come down.
Well, I'm not saying that it's wrong. I was reading about, you know, things like the Cleveland Clinic was doing, which were actually changing behavior of people that are on their health plans, which, you know, they were claiming were bringing down healthcare costs much more dramatically than trying to control costs of medications and various other things.
I would actually argue that, I mean, let's be quite clear. We do not control prices in the United States, and that is, I mean, that's what Stephen Brill's article was about. That's what, you know, sort of everything, you know, that's mm-hmm. been talked about recently, that it's prices.
Fascinating article.
It is prices. And it's the fact, the one thing we never discuss doing in the United States is price controls, except in Maryland, which has an all-payer system. And, you know, again, not to keep pointing to evidence, but Maryland's healthcare costs have been rising slower than almost any other state in the nation because they set all-payer prices. That is what Germany does. That is what Switzerland does. That is what Israel does. That is what many, many, many countries do to slow the cost of care, because so much of it is just the prices. And so Cleveland Clinic looks great compared to the rest of the country in the United States, and we should applaud what they're doing, and that's what we're trying to do in many ways with the Affordable Care Act for the rest of the country. But we shouldn't kid ourselves that, you know, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. Compared to the rest of the world, the Cleveland Clinic still performs quite poorly because they just do a better job by going right to the source and actually controlling the one thing that is driving the system, and, you know, so much harder than everything else, it's prices. And we don't like it in the United States. We feel like somehow that's not right. But that is the mechanism by which other countries, you know, control the cost of their healthcare system. The people working in the healthcare system still make a great living. It doesn't
and
have
I to did be want to hear about privacy before.
Privacy. Okay, so you bring up a legitimate concern about, you know, privacy, and which is why everyone should be.
But not only the fact that your privacy might be leaked, but if you look even in the, you know, Second Amendment debate, there's, you know, I think it's like 30-something states that refuse to give information about people they deem as mentally dangerous because yep. they're worried about violating HIPAA. I mean, privacy in medical, you know, care seems to be, you know, crazy.
Well, it's crazy in the sense that HIPAA is not the cleanest of laws, and, you know, there are things that apply to HIPAA. In other words, if I transmit something by email, I have to have 10,000 more safeguards than if I were to fax it or mail it. And that makes no sense because, you know, why should one form be so much more protected than
faxing,
another form?
Faxing or mailing is way less secure than an email. The email is only going to be opened by the person who gets it. Anybody can pick up a fax.
They do it because they think that somehow it's mass going to leak. But, you know, at some point we have to sort of just weigh whether we want efficiency in the healthcare system or not. We can all be secure that no one's ever going to be able to, or theoretically it's going to be harder for the government, although they could still do it, believe me, to get in and get their healthcare records, and that leads to huge inefficiencies and terrible quality in the healthcare system. Or we could own that, you know, at some point if the government really wants to get your medical information, they can get it today. You know, they can still get it. They can serve a subpoena. They can go get it. They can go pick it up. Or they can do it illegally. It's all there. They can go get it. And we're having an incredibly inefficient, very expensive, lower quality healthcare system. Right. I think we're going to have to get over the boogeyman somehow. You know, all of a sudden our medical data is going to be used against us. Your medical data can be used against you now. We need proper safeguards. We need people watching over this. We need to constantly be aware, constantly have debates, talk about it, keep it out in the open, make sure it's a concern. But we shouldn't let the fear of what could potentially happen make us have what we're happening right now, which, again, is an incredibly expensive, low access, reasonably poor sometimes quality, you know, healthcare system.
Yeah. Pete, always great to have you calling. Really, really smart, thoughtful guy. Before we let you go, I want to talk about dieting. You've been writing a lot about dieting. You wrote a piece for CNN. You've written about organic food for CNN, debunking some of the myths that you perceive there. That your wife and my wife still don't want to listen to necessarily. But you have a piece at the Incidental Economist, your blog, called Picking the Diet That Works for You. I mean, come on. This isn't rocket science.
Well, you know, this is what everybody says. But if it wasn't rocket science, it would work. You know, it would be easy to do. You know, and I think that, you know, I agree with you it's not rocket science in the sense that everybody knows how weight loss is supposed to work. If you eat less calories than you need to burn off, you will lose weight. Having said that, it's not working, you know, and we can blame society and we can blame individuals and we can blame, but we're not fixing this problem. And when we try to fix it, it often creates more anger than fixing it. I'm not a proponent of the soda ban in New York City. I think it's a silly policy and I don't think it was going to work. But at the same time, the backlash against it or the people mocking it or, you know, saying like, well, now it's freedom to drink a huge, you know, sugar-laden soda, that's not helpful either. And I think we've gotten to a point where everybody is so busy lecturing everyone else and conflating it into some measure either of freedom or totalitarianism. We got to stop doing this and just, you know, figure out what works for individuals and try to do a better job of having a little more, I think, compassion and thoughtfulness into, you know, trying to find individual ways for people to take better care of themselves in general. But, you know, that's just not about diet. That's probably a better healthcare system in general.
But, I mean, the bottom line is people who are trying to lose weight, it's different solutions for different people, different food and different types of exercise. And I think a lot of people are looking for a magic bullet. They try all kinds of different diets, from the Atkins diet to what other kind of fad diets there are. But the truth is we're not created equal.
No, I think it's partially so we're not creating.
I mean, I am
also,
obviously, for example, like me versus you, I have the metabolism of a gazelle and you don't, but you have hair and I don't.
Correct. And I, you know, and I might have to eat different things or I make different choices. But what I'm tired of is people telling me or when I hear people tell each other that they're doing it wrong, that, you know, that this diet is silly or that diet's not going to work or this diet. It's like, you know what, it might. And this is not one of those. We have literally like no big studies that show this is the one that works. That's why there's 10 million options. And when we have no evidence, and I think I'm pretty consistent about this, then I'm not going to lecture you on what the best thing is, nor should anybody else. It's basically at that point, it's a choice. It's whatever works for you and you think will bring you success. And I think a lot of people just need to get off their high horse about, you know, lecturing what is the correct way to do it or the right way to do it or the wrong way to do it. There's probably a way that works for everyone. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, and it doesn't mean that everybody should just give up. But I think that, you know, there's too many people speaking with authority that this is what you need to do or that is what you need to do and that's the solution when, you know, nobody's even sure what's causing this, let alone how to.
Although there is evidence on a number of different measures for some very specific things, and you've written a lot about that in your books that debunk myths. And if you don't have those books, folks, you should get them. They are
evidence,
awesome. Like
I'm
like
all
eggs
for it, yeah.
Like to give me one before we leave, but some evidence about dieting or exercise. You've written both about, you know, getting better abs and stretching before workouts, as well as eggs and cholesterol. And
unfortunately, most of those things are just proving that things don't work. Like, you know, the idea that sit-ups are going to make you have a rock-hard stomach is just totally made up. And then, especially with the losing weight, it's, you know, I was told for years that, like, if you eat at night, you're going to get fat, that eating at night is a bad thing. And then, you know, people will even try to cite research, but it turns out that was bad research. When you look at the good research, it, of course, doesn't matter what time you eat. The body doesn't care. You know, it doesn't digest it at that minute. And so the idea that if you eat at night versus eating at the morning versus eating in the middle of the day is somehow going to change your overall body weight, there's just nothing to that and no evidence at all. Unfortunately, that's how most of the evidence about weight loss goes. It's just that what people lecture you to do turns out isn't true at all.
Well, speaking of research, the American Heart Association conference this week, there was a new research presented that sugar-sweetened beverages are linked to more than 180,000 obesity-related deaths worldwide each year. What do you think? Have you heard about that?
And this is one where I've got to go back and read it, because I think you're the second person since yesterday who's quoted that to me. And every time they do something like that, the first thing to do is say, well, how many deaths was that actually versus the rest, you know, versus how many people died in the world that year? Because it could be a very tiny percentage in which it's irrelevant. But the other thing is that how much can they tease that out? You know, how much is it the actual beverage versus everything else they were eating? And sometimes people who drink huge sugar-sweetened beverages are also eating completely unhealthy things on top of that, or not exercising, or doing one of any million other things. There's no silver bullet here. There just isn't. You know, if you can get rid of a big soda in New York City, but they haven't outlawed the 1,500-calorie piece of cheesesteak, the 2,000-calorie burger, or the big beer that you could have, or, you know, the fact that you can fill up the soda twice, or that you can still go to the store to buy. It's like they picked one thing, focused on one area in one place, and why? You know, it's not that, like, this one beverage and one size is what's getting us. It's an entire lifestyle and the way we eat. And to try to attack one without trying to attack the others is not going to work. And, you know, we should talk about this next time, because there's good policy. They've tried out in other countries to try to target this kind of stuff, and it often doesn't work because people will find loopholes. You need a holistic solution.
Quite presumptuous for you to assume there's going to be a next time.
You know what? You're absolutely right. I should be begging, you know. like Jake Tapper, I'm sure will.
Jake Tapper about to join us. Thank you for the tease and the help promoting what's coming up next. Jake Tapper of CNN.
I'm segueing.
Bumping Dr. Aaron Carroll's second part of this interview. So.
Well, you know, what are you going to do?
Thank you very much, sir.
Anytime.
Give him a follow on Twitter, @AaronECarroll, @AaronECarroll. We'll talk to Jake Tapper, who's hosting a new show on CNN called The Lead. He's also an author of an amazing new book called The Outpost, about a group of men in Afghanistan who were ambushed. It's unbelievably well-written. He went to Afghanistan to write it, and he's hosting a new show on CNN. Jake Tapper, when we come back.